Thank you for downloading this Standard Issue podcast. In this episode, we join editor Mickey Noonan on stage at MacFest 2016, and in conversation with guests Izzy Sutty, Amy Annette, and Kiri Pritchard-McLean. All our podcasts are available on iTunes and directly from standardissuemagazine.com/podcasts.
Apologies that she can't be here. She's really gutted, but it's down to personal reasons, but she sends you all lots of love. So welcome to In Conversation with Standard Issue. It's great to be at MacFest. Our guests tonight are Izzy Sutty, Amy Annette, and Kiri Pritchard-McLean. And let's check before we get going. Give me a cheer if you read Standard Issue. Okay, let's convert the rest of you buggers. Great, so I'm gonna go in with a big question. Are you ready?
Yes.
How did you know you were a feminist? What was your sort of light bulb moment that you were a feminist? And we'll start with Kiri.
I didn't have like a great light bulb moment. It was the first time I heard myself say out loud. I was at Weekstock Festival, which is on the Fian Peninsula, which is where I'm from Bangor in North Wales, which is where we go to take drugs for the weekend. And I was hammered. And we decided we should go swimming in the sea, which is what you do when you're on drugs and intoxicated, very nearly a statistic. And I was like, there was a path, but for some reason I decided to climb over a barbed wire fence. And as I was climbing over, this guy went to help me, and I heard myself say, "Get your hands off me, I'm a feminist." And then I went, "Oh, I'm a feminist." That's happened. And then I probably slipped on the barbed wire fence. I've got permanent T scars. I have one on my face as well. I got caught on the top, like when you see a bin bag on it. And I ripped my jeans, and I had to put them on backwards, because the rippers had my vagina hanging out. And that's when I knew that I was a feminist.
Really isn't easy being a woman, being a feminist.
Very tough.
Amy?
That just made me remember all the times that I was too short to climb over the walls and the fences as I like followed all of my friends were boys, and all the times I was like, you can do it, you can do it, be a girl, you can do it, and the amount of times I really hurt myself.
I'm a feminist, but it still makes my bits twitch when the guys do that thing where they put their hands on one side of the wall and then just flip over.
Yeah. In a good way, Twitch.
Yeah, excellent way.
Yeah.
I'm just like an instant like virtual cramps.
We went like cramps. When did I know I was a feminist? I have the sort of the luck of having a very feminist mother. She's a publisher, a feminist publisher, and so I didn't know that I was a feminist, but obviously I definitely was. And so obviously that's fantastic. And what girl wouldn't want to be brought up that way? But it did mean that when I encountered sexism, I was so confused. I was so confused. So I just remember being the first time we were sort of split into boys and girls, and the activity was like unfair. You know, I mean, I'm not even sure exactly what it was. I just really remember the sort of like sinking feeling that like it just didn't make sense. I guess that's sort of like the post-world ideal of our children being like, what's this unknown feeling, sexism? But I definitely experienced that. But I think I've always been, since then, been very conscious of how privileged I was to have a feminist mother. That's the end of my sentence.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Similar to you, we didn't really talk about it a lot at home. I just always got taught that I could do sort of anything I wanted to do within reason. Like, obviously I was never gonna be good at French, which I felt A level, but my parents weren't like, darling, you could do anything you like, be an acrobat, but they were kind of like very encouraging and supportive of me doing this job. I think of feminism in relation to my job, but like you, I never really sort of thought
am I a feminist? Am I different from men? I just always felt quite confident about what I was doing. And then it was only when I started to get asked what it was like to be a female comedian that I started to think about it, because that's such a bizarre question that we get asked time and time again.
Do you still get that question?
Yeah, absolutely. And then what they do is, instead of asking it, they sort of go, how do you feel about being asked what it's like to be a female? You're like, you're still asking it. You're trying to get two answers for the price of one. But I always say to that, I don't know what it's like to be a man. I can just say that I absolutely love comedy and feel very happy to be making a living from it. But there are times that you do notice the difference, I think, like on the circuit. And I hate having to think about that. But there was a bit of like a moment where I was at like a folk evening with some of my parents' friends, and it was like one of those evenings where everyone knows the words except for you. You know, when like someone picks up a guitar and is like, the maid is in the scullery, and everyone looks really solemn and sits on it. It's like, oh my God. And for some reason afterwards, this guy there was like talking about, I'd done something on the radio, and was like, he said, oh, I don't listen to Woman's Hour, you're not a feminist, are you? And then I said, yes, I am. I felt really offended, and that was like, that was really recently, in the last sort of 5 or 6 years. But
do you think it's still quite a hard word to own, because there's quite a lot of negative connotations about it?
Yeah, and I think there are lots of different types of feminists, and I think there are people who everyone has a different definition of it. And I don't know what you guys thought about the Kim Kardashian naked photo thing. Yeah. That was a really good example of something that got people talking.
Empowered.
Yeah, I'm not sure how I felt about
it. It's Kathleen Hanna from Bikini Girls who said that there's as many types of feminism as there are women, which I think is a nice way of thinking about it. Like, I don't think it needs to be a catch-all you all have to fit into. But that's something that I really espouse, and I do realise it means that at one point we were doing a talk for this book that I was part of, and someone put their hand up and they're like, but where's the line? At some point something is not going to be feminist.
I'd say it's Depa Laugh saying he's a feminist on Newsnight.
Yeah, that's my line. But it's like, this thing I talk about or try to talk about on stage is that it's like, you know, feminism is like the reverse of a bread roll, because like a bread roll is just one thing, but in some places it's a balm, and some places it's a stotty and earth and bottom and things. But feminism is the reverse of that. It's different things all given the same name. So it's, and that's what's difficult, because you don't get to tell someone else that their one is wrong. You just have to, I don't know, mute them on Twitter. Like, it is really hard, because I'm still figuring out what my one is, because it changes all the time, as I try and not just be like, well, you know, access it through my own. I'm a white and I went to private school for a bit and I'm incredibly lucky, so this is my feminism. And I have to, like, there's more to it than that, I'm striving to be a better one.
I think you already are a good one. I think, like,
thank you, that's what that was about.
But I think, like, dealing with your privilege, to use that buzz, like, not a buzzword, that makes it sound like not an important word, to dealing with your privilege is something that's different, I think, to dealing with, I think it's basically, I would like everyone to understand, like, accept that they can be feminist and be confused about what that means. Like, I'm happy to be English, but I also hate England, you know, I hate it so much. And like, but that's fine, I can understand that I am it, but then I'm within it, I have problems with what it means. But
why,
I accept it.
Why do you hate England?
It's just so bad. So bad. Like, I was just in New Zealand, and it's like, everything is sort of the same, but it's so nice. Like, there's mountains everywhere.
You know, you have that here. Wales more. That's what you want to do.
Yeah.
You got it all wrong.
New South Wales, I mean, that's what's strange. It was nice. But I think you can accept that you're a feminist and then deal with what it means. I think the barrier to accepting that you're a feminist, or saying that you're a feminist, should be lower, is much lower than people think it is.
Mm.
So when did you realise you were funny women and wanted to do comedy or have a sort of comedy within your working life? I'll start with
Missy. Well, I always wanted to do performing and I always wanted to write songs, and then it just, I suppose, happened naturally, really. I was writing songs that were supposedly serious, and they were about, I was really into Frank Zappa, so they just come out weird, so I'd go on at a normal night, and there'd be like loads of people doing like love songs in A minor about the girlfriends and boyfriends and stuff, and then I'd do a song about like an accountant called Martin who speared himself with a fry up every night before he went to sleep. His parents were really worried about him. People go into great detail about his life. And I used to try and sort of get like, I wanted to write a pop song to other people for bits of that, where people just hear the accountant song and go, you know, I don't know if you quite fit into our world. But then I dilly-dallied a bit. I went on, did a lot of gigs on the gay circuit. I won a competition on the gay circuit and then did some gigs there and then sort of did lots of different types of gigs, cabaret gigs. And then after a while I was like, right, I'm ready to try the sort of open mic comedy circuit. But it was like, I had to sort of skate around it a little bit and go, oh, where do I fit in before? But I think early on I realised that I loved making people laugh, and it was always songs first for me rather than speech. So I did a song that, looking back, was horrendous, without the three chords in it, when I was at college, about the perfect guy.
Was it Martin?
It wasn't Martin, actually, although, you know, I'm happily engaged now, but, you know, hypothetically, if I met a guy to fry up, so it wouldn't be a no-no for me. You know? I just had to sort of learn to live with it. I just had to change the sheets a lot.
But he can change the sheets?
Yeah, he can change the sheets, yeah. I met you, I was like the proverbial you, yeah. Or you could come and live with us.
That's fine,
yeah.
As well.
For me it was always songs. The first time that I performed a song that I'd written that was supposed to be funny and that got a laugh was the best feeling, really, because I'd written it as well as performing it.
God, mine's going to seem shallow now, isn't it?
That's why you're here.
I have always been a chronic show-off. And, youngest of three by a big stretch, only girl, always just been a big old show off. And then at some point I realised that I think being funny was the quickest way to get the most amount of people to pay attention to me. So I was like, well, I'll just do that then. And I had started.
Go on, Karen.
I was going to say, you've got to be funny initially, haven't you? Which you are. So it's that thing where you are already funny, and it's like you're learning how to.
Yeah, actually, it's weird. I don't still see myself as funny, even though it's what I do, so it's weird. And I don't know, because I remember I taught you to do like drama and stuff, I like doing plays and things, and I didn't like learning lines because I was like, don't want to say other people's words, and I really liked writing. And it was mad. Now I look back, when I was like 15 or 16, I was writing loads of comedy for this like little drama club I was in, doing loads of performing. And then at no point someone said, well, it should be comedy that you do. They were like, I suppose you want to be an actress. And I didn't, but I was like, okay. And then sort of like went, I suppose this is what I'm going to pretend to do for a bit. And I never really pursued it to any great deal. And then when I found stand-up, I was like, oh, this is it. This is what I was meant to do. So yeah, I think when I was like about 21, 22, I did a comedy course, which was a waste of everyone's time. Don't go and do them. And then I just sort of started doing it. But yeah, I loved it because the thing, one of the many things that didn't really appeal to me about acting is you have to decide. Someone else has to decide to give you a chance. And the thing about stand-up is you do it, and if you're good, you just get on. It's like such a meritocracy like that. So you just decide to do your job and you do it, and no one can go, well, you're not thin enough, or you're not this, or you're not right for this part, or that person's got more TV credit. Well, actually, that does happen later on. But I just thought it was really enabling. So yeah, that's why.
Do you think comedy has a currency to make a difference and to reach people in a way that other genres can't?
I would like to say yes, otherwise I would stop doing it. But I wish the Arts Council would realise that and stop giving everything else but stand-up funding. Because I think great stand-up can generally make a difference and affect a change. Like, I try and sneak stuff in. So I've got like a bit that I do about, this is true, crabs, pubic hairlines are dying out. Because of the destruction of their natural habitat, which is amazing. So gorgeous, isn't it? So I do a bit about, like, two little bits, and it ends on me saying to my boyfriend that, as well as being an area of outstanding natural beauty, it's also a conservation zone. And there's nothing more glorious as a feminist than having, like, that get a round of applause in Bristol Jumblers. Like, my hairy fanny getting a round of applause in Bristol Jumblers is like, yeah! And it's like, so it's sneaking stuff in, because like that's what I try. It's like stealth politics. That's why I try and do it. That if you can like take an idea, because that's when I try and write stuff. I take an idea I want to talk about, and I go, okay, how can I make this something that I would want to listen to? Because I like that's when it strays away, when you start being like, and another thing you should think, and you know, being pious. But I think it's amazing because you can just sneak information over, and then they'll laugh along, and then hopefully when they leave, they'll go, oh, like something will sink in there. So yeah, I think it can be.
So you're like a comedy ninja.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Oh, that's nice, comedy ninja.
Although with the sequins, it's gonna
yeah.
So what you make people laugh, Issy, what never fails to make you piss yourself off in?
Well, I don't tend to laugh at the kind of stuff that I do, weirdly. I think you end up doing what's most natural for you to do. I think it takes trial and error. It took me a long time to go, oh yeah, I want to tell long stories with songs in them, basically, where I sing in character, and I don't have that many short bits. And I wish I had more stuff like that. I think I...
What, crabs?
Yeah. Don't worry, I've run that door
first. Sideways though, yeah.
Just ask how you act to waitress, actually.
If that was the thing.
I tend to write more stories about people rather than stuff about myself, I suppose. Although I do write more stuff about myself than I used to. But what I tend to laugh at, I mean, the kind of stand-ups I like, I don't think are that similar to me. Like, I really like Simon Amstel. I don't think he's Phil Kay. There's only a few. And I love those people who are my mates, but that feels very weird to say their names. So I love lots and lots of women stand-ups as well, but because they're like some of my best mates, it's always very strange. But I think Phil Kay is probably the best person I've ever seen live, because he just, if anyone's seen him, but he just sort of does something seemingly spontaneous, and he seems somehow to capture the joy and the misery of life at once. And for me, that's, I think, the secret of stand-up. Really, and I don't think you should realise that that's going on. I think people want to feel all together, and they want to feel that there is hope, but also that life is completely flawed. I think that comedy has got absolutely the power to. I mean, like Kiri said, that's the amazing thing about it. You can think of an idea and then be on stage that night trying it, and there's no other medium like that, really. And think theatre's got the power to change stuff as well. But as a stand-up, you're very powerful, and that can be good and bad, because then you've got people like Dapper Laughs, I suppose, who, you know, who says stuff that I think is wrong and other people think is right. Everyone's got a different opinion about it. But I think when anyone says anything that's an opinion and works it into stand-up, I don't think anyone could take offence at the crowd and be like, no, all women must shave. But maybe something more political, or do you know what I mean? People are always going to agree and disagree with it. So for that reason, depending on your viewpoint, you might think that it's good that comedy's powerful, or that it's bad. Because if you think of like misogynist comedy from really not that long ago, and some of it's around now, people love it.
I think it's really interesting that comedy is in like the entertainment sections when you look in magazines and things, and like it's like the art section and then the entertainment section, mm-hmm. and comedy is in the entertainment section, which I think is really interesting, especially like at this kind of festival where there's such an interchange between theatre and comedy, like, you know, and I guess shows like this, where this all fits within sort of the thing of comedy, but we're sitting in the entertainment section. I think that's really powerful. But and the whole thing of people being like, we just need engagement, we need engagement so bad. And I think comedy doesn't suffer from that, you know, whereas theatre does suffer from the sort of the demographics of people who go and see it, and the sort of the echo chamber idea of people just who already agree, seeing, going to theatre and seeing something they agree with. But so I think comedy, yeah, totally has power to be a really powerful currency. I think Sarah is a great representation of that. Like, she's just a very funny person. And then in your show, you're saying how, I don't give away the end of your show, but it's basically people being like, we love Sarah.
Yeah.
And that's the change in which that she is affected. She represents to some people a funny woman that they can all get behind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When I've asked Sarah about being a feminist, she says that she might not talk about it specifically in her shows, but just by doing what she does, and by being as successful as she is, that's feminist in itself.
Yeah, totally, yeah. She's one woman in those huge arenas, mm-hmm. and she has all the power, and everyone is listening to her, and it's not a and she doesn't have to talk about it. I think even not having to apologise or explain why you're there, that's really powerful. And that's what you see in sort of the best feminist thinkers and like speakers who don't necessarily call themselves feminists. I guess it's how we like interact with pop stars as well. It's like we allow them a voice and like an image and they get to choose their music. But then actually that's interesting, isn't it? Because you talk about Svengali figures and like the men in the background. And you were talking in your show about how people still think that female comics have their material written by men. Like that's a common a comment people have all the time.
My boyfriend did write a crab bit.
That's true.
Did he start that one?
God, do people really think that? No one's ever asked me about that. Maybe it's something that I just assume.
Let's clear it up. Let's clear it up now. Who writes your material?
God. God is genderless, guys. It's not a man.
No, I do. What did you want to be as a kid? Was it comedy?
I used to say to my parents, me and Samira Sabai, who was a boy in my school, we were going to go round the world in a helicopter saving all the animals. So that was a very clear idea that I had.
Is that a genuine career choice?
I went to private school, I was told I could do anything. yeah, and well, that is the other thing, that my parents, so I'm a farmer's daughter, and you probably all think I met my dad. My mum's the farmer.
Ooh.
My brothers are older, and growing up on a farm, there was things I couldn't do, but I was never told it was because I was a girl. It was only just because I was little. And as soon as I was big as the boys, I'd be able to do the same things. So I totally had that self-belief as a kid. And like at primary school, I remember playing football because all the boys were. I didn't like football, but I thought, well, I'm not going to be the only one not playing it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just doing things that I thought, like, well, that's the space that I should be in. And so, yeah, I obviously thought that helicopters was also a space I should be occupying, yeah. Saving all the animals.
What, even the ones in the sea? I'm not going to do
one. I'll be honest, Nikki, I've not thought it through. This is also at the time I used to say, when I have children, I want one black baby and one white baby. And if I'd stuck at home, that would have been absolutely fine as well. That's normal. But... I had some very clear ideas about the world.
How do you do it from the helicopter? Throw food at them?
I mean, that's for someone else to sort out. I'm the ideas man.
It would have got full quickly, but maybe you could have had centres that you drop them off at.
See?
Oh, you pick them up with the helicopter?
I don't know, do I? As a five-year-old, I didn't think my idea would get this much scrutiny. I was going to get dragon's den, to be honest.
If anyone can work out how we can get Kiri to fulfill her dream now that Jimmy Savile's gone. What did you want to be as a kid, Amy?
Oh, I always used to think this was quite a charming thing, but I actually think it makes me sound like an egomaniac. So I really wanted to be the President of America. I remember telling someone, being like, this is going to be so charming. And they were like, oh, God. I tried to not do it anymore. But yeah, I just said, my dad's American. So I was just like, yeah, fine.
Can you please run? Because it's looking really dodgy.
I actually volunteered for the Obama campaign. Thank you very much. In 2012, so the easy year, when he was definitely going to win. And it was really interesting going out there. And I think I can't remember how old I was in 2012, but that was the time I was like, I'm not going to do this.
You were 4 years younger than you are now.
I'm so bad at that.
Society's just told it you are.
Yes, but I am, but I agree. but yeah, I remember, it took me a very long time to accept that I wasn't going to be the president. But it's a lot of work, so you don't get a lot of sleep. I really like sleep. You always go grey in the job. Which I think is the reason that it's so scary that David Cameron is not all grey.
Yeah,
8 hours a night sleep. He said that in an interview. You should not get that much if you're the Prime Minister.
How much does he get?
8.
Oh,
it's too much.
Gross.
That's why he's not going grey.
Almost, I'd say that's the worst thing he's done.
It's sleeping. But you know the thing that, like, if you spoke to anyone from any political identity, you'd be like, yeah, fine, I get you're conservative. Do you know he sleeps 8 hours a night? No.
God. Unless that's how much sleep all politicians should get, and Margaret Thatcher was just wrong in that sense.
And if she don't get all the
things she ever did. She used to get like 2 hours, didn't she?
Four hours.
But that was just so she could recharge the battery, wasn't it? Missy, what did you want to be when you were little?
I just always wanted to be an actress. Always.
Yeah.
Apart from about 2 weeks, I jumped off a bridge for a bet for a pound into a shallow river, because it was raining, it looked deeper than it was, and I landed with my foot at right angles to my ankle and broke it in quite an odd way, so I had to have the cast on for a while and I couldn't walk from it. So I got really into Wimbledon because I just sat on the sofa and I've never watched tennis before. So then I decided for those sort of 2 or 3 weeks I was going to be a tennis player, and that was much more realistic than being an actress. despite the fact that I've never played tennis in my life, and I'm not that sporty. But basically, my daydreams consisted of me planning out what colour hair I was going to have and how I was going to entertain the people in the crowd between shots. So, I think it was just another version of being a performer, but where I got to hit the ball a bit as well. And then I was like, Mum, why didn't you recognise I should be a tennis player? She was like, what? So me and my mate Caroline went to the park. I was like, right, I'm going to start making up for lost time. And I worked out if I practiced every day before school, I could get really good. And we went once at like 6 in the morning. I did like a few shots and I was like, let's go for a fag. So that was the only time. I did set up at, so I always wanted to be like a performer. I suppose actress, because I didn't know, a bit like Kiri was saying, I didn't know, everyone always used to say, oh, you want to be an actress, because I wanted to write stuff and songs especially. And but because people used to be like, oh, be an actress because you like doing sketches as well. But I started this dating agency when I was about 12, I used to write songs for other girls about a boy. So they'd like, so like, Amy come to me, so I really fancy this guy called Darren. He's got brown hair and blue eyes, and his dad drives an Audi. And I'd be like, okay, I'll write a song about him. And then you'd give me like a mini baby bell, and I'd write it. And then it would be like, for him, from her point of view.
Did she perform it?
Well, what would happen was that invariably, the person in your shoes wouldn't want to perform it, so I'd perform it on your behalf. So it got very complicated. We had to say, a song for Darren from Amy, and then I'd perform it. It was always on cassette tape, we haven't done it live. No, they did not. I did not.
It's like that film with Steve Martin. Is it what
it's like? Yeah, where he's telling.
You totally make that from Steve Martin.
No.
Men write all of the jokes. Kiri, you do quite a lot of work with kids, don't you?
Yeah, not kids, like young people.
Young people.
I volunteer in a youth provision centre near where I live in Manchester, because it's quite an impoverished area. It's very near Bernard Manning's Embassy Club. What a delight that place is. I'm having my 30th there, I'm so fucking excited. they've got a big board outside saying we do christenings, birthdays, weddings, not civil partnerships. That's in brackets. So yeah, basically it's quite a poor area, so I volunteer in this place, and I work as a mentor, so you get paired up with a young person, and you just have to sort of be there, basically give them an hour a week of your time, and just sort of be there for them, talk about whatever they want. I mean, sometimes they want help with maths homework, but more often than not, there's something else going on, because it's a mixture of young people who have been referred by their school or parents or the staff at the centre, or have referred themselves. Gone, I think I might like someone to talk to. So yeah, I do that.
And do the young women that you deal with seem more switched on? Do you think it's kind of, it's an odd question, but do you think it's easier or harder being a young woman in today's society than we had it?
In my instance, compared to people I work with, and I know there's all sorts of other extraneous variables, is terrifying what our young people are going through these days. I remember being sort of aware of my appearance, but they are bombarded and consumed. Yeah, there's also a huge, keep it light, Kiri. there's an epidemic at the moment, I'm sure you guys will know, with young people, that like self-harm rates have risen in the last 2 years by, I think it's like 93%. So it's now become cultural. So now when people feel sad, they know to self-harm, that's what you do. And there's a culture as well of like social media, so they will Snapchat to each other, there's a competitive element. So it's horrible because our girls are, the world is telling them they don't look right, and they're taking it out on their bodies, and it's just incredibly sad. And that's, I mean, I said it when I did the thing last time, but the only time I see the girls that I work with become articulate is when they talk about how much they hate their bodies. Like, I mean, they're almost monosyllabic when they're talking about other stuff, and they can just go, oh, it was good or nice. But when they talk about their bodies and what they want to change and how they would change it and what they're going to do, then they suddenly, you know, their recovery expands and they're very passionate, and it's just so, it's incredibly sad. None of the girls I work with would attend a talk by a journalist in school. They would be lucky to be in school, like you'd be lucky to find them in school. So there's just, I think what it goes, this bypasses gender in general, but you have a very big disengaged group of people who, like, it's a very scary world. Yeah.
Is it like the lads as well? Like with the self-harm thing, yeah. Does it seem to be more of a girl thing?
It's more of a girl thing, but it does with guys as well, and obviously eating disorders as well in young men is on the rise. But I mean, it's like the thing is that there is the potential in these young women. I work the nice side is like they're the ones who are there. They want to feel more about themselves than they do. They, you know, they want to make a change. It's just giving them the tools to do that, whether that's the confidence or the support, or, you know, there's something to go and do, you know, because if they're drifting through college, they don't really know what they want to do, and they just need that thing that goes, that suddenly they've got a new priority that isn't what they look like.
It's really, when you sort of pull back and you realise what do options do people have, young people have, when they come out of any sort of education at all, like, there's just not that interest in it. Like, there's interest in bankers, and there's interest, you know what I mean? There's just no interest in looking at what's available for young people.
Yeah. I remember when I was in high school, I was like a sixth former, and they would pair some sixth formers up with young people who were bright, but were in a social group usually where that was not cool. And I remember I got put with this girl called, a different name I'm going to change quickly, Ellen. And Ellen, so I was like, yeah, so I was like, who's the best person in the world?
Oh, Ellen
Jenner. I got put with her, and I remember she was like, proper fucking banger. And she would never get lower than 98% on science and maths. She's incredibly bright, but used to hide her test results because she thought the friends had took a piss. So they set me up with her, and they were like, try and get her to realise that there's something. And I remember being like sitting down, I was like, so, like, have you thought about university? Because for me, I think I was, even though no one else in my family had been to university before, I was just going to go to university, because that's obviously where I get my helicopter licence. and I remember sitting with her, and I was like, so what do you want to do? And she's like, I don't know, I'll just like maybe get a job or something, like my cousin works somewhere. And I was like, what about university? And she was like, I just didn't get it. And I was like, you get money to get hammered. Like, that is what it is. You go and have fun for 3 years, fuck a load of people, and you get paid for it. And she was like, and then I worked with her for a bit, and then I just sort of didn't see her again. And then I was out for a night out, like, years later, and I was hammered. And she was like, Kitty? And I was like, Ellen? And she was like, I did it, I went and got hammered. So she's a scientist now. So like you can, like there has to be intervention somewhere. And so what I'm saying is tell the young people to get shit-faced, it works.
You know the solution first,
yeah.
I'll just go and get pissed. Okay, let's light it up a little bit.
Yeah.
What is the most embarrassing thing that has ever happened to you? I'm going to start with Issy.
Oh.
Get more of that face.
God, well I'm just trying to think. There's like this sort of rom-com thing that actually isn't, in hindsight, that embarrassing. But I used to have this long skirt which was like net on the outside and then a skirt on the inside. And I went to the toilet and the inside bit had tucked into my knickers for ages and you could see them. But that just feels like something you'd write in. It was embarrassing. But I hadn't had it like that for ages. But that's shit. It feels like something you'd write and then go, let's take that out. It doesn't feel like it'd happen.
Do you put yourself in situations to see if you can get some gags out of it?
No, my boyfriend is slamming as well. He complains now that I haven't got a baby, but he
that nothing interesting happens to him anymore, and he has to try and like go to a festival or something and like meet people who talk in rhyme and stuff. But
I think they're called rappers.
Yes. You can tell how long it is since I've been there. Those people are talking rhyme. I'm just covered in baby sick. No, she's 18 months now. She isn't sick anymore, but that's all I got pretty much. I genuinely don't think that I get embarrassed in the same way as the average person. I also think that where I'm from, in Matlock, I grew up with a group of girls where we'd just do stuff and then tell everyone, like, you know, we'd be like, I've got thrush, to everyone, just didn't care. And because we were all like that, that was the way we became. So I'm struck, I'll have a little think while the others are talking, if anything. Mm.
Okay.
Yeah, but I can't think of anything that I'm not prepared to say and try and make it into material.
Okay, in that case, is there anything that's kind of off bounds for you, material-wise? Is there anything that you think, I can't joke about that, it's too personal, or it's not right?
It's
not right, I just not right.
I don't think there's anything that's off bounds generally to me. Like, if I'm watching someone else, I think rape is always. So I thought you were going to lighten it up now.
I didn't say rape.
No, I know. I think.
She wasn't going to be like, kittens, was she?
No, I'm not sure about that. Guinea pigs, I just can't. I think the rape joke thing is a really interesting debate, and I think I would never, ever write a joke about rape. I don't think. I think it's difficult because some people say there shouldn't be anything that's off bounds and comedy should be free speech. I think the secret to any joke, especially about something that's very delicate and powerful like that, where you are wielding so much power, is that you have to be very much the victim of the joke if you're telling it. So sometimes I think a joke can appear to be about something very offensive, but actually it's not. It's about the person who's telling it being a bit of a dick in the joke. But I think then you still have to be so careful with what subject you choose, because it can be so upsetting to people. I think you could say something lightly as a comic and not realise the connotation to people. So I think for me personally, there are things like that that I probably wouldn't joke about and that I don't find funny. If I'm watching, I always think, whenever I've seen a joke about rape, I've never failed to feel offended, and I've never failed to think, I don't think you should have made that choice. And for me personally, there are some things like my dad dying that I haven't ever talked about, just because I don't think I could say anything funny about it. It's not that I never would, but I think it had to get to a point where I felt it was funny enough to talk about it, and, you know, and to justify talking about it. I think when it's anything that isn't kind of something that naturally springs to mind, you have to think, right, is it the right approach, and blah, blah, blah. But to be honest, it's quite an organic process. Like, I bet you didn't necessarily sit down and think, I want to write something about crab. Do you know what I mean? It's just something that comes into your head, isn't it? And you think, oh, I'm excited about it. So I think...
Excited about crabs?
Yeah. Well, yeah, because you're thinking, oh my God, I can say this thing and it'll be really brilliant. And, you know, so I think that's the way anyway to do comedy, to kind of think about things that make you excited and that you think you've got a unique approach to. And I would think that if you're approaching it, if you're thinking, how offensive can I be? Not that that was your question, but I'm just thinking about the opposite. Some people probably do think about that, don't
they?
Yeah,
I know some people who do.
Do they, like, think, what can I say that's the most shocking thing?
Yeah, I think there's a, like, with newer acts as well, that there's a thing that's, they haven't worked, because it's a reaction, and they're not used to getting one, so them saying something horrendous, and a crowd going, ooh, or that, ooh, and then a laugh, they're like, ah, yeah, delicious, but it's because it is a reaction, as opposed to them just dying on their ass in a pub in Preston, so at least someone is reacting to what they're saying. But yeah, I agree with what you're saying. I do have, like, not a joke about rape, but I use the word rape in the joke. It's about rape apologists, and it's definitely on the right side of things. But just saying the word will change the air, like it did in here now, because it's such a serious thing. It just changes the air. So I would just be like, well, because it's so hard to like go to an audience. I promise I'm on the right. I read The Guardian, guys. I've got a moon cup in right now. Like, honestly, I'm on the right side. But
can be a little bit literally slapdash
with I've got a pair of boots that are stained, let's put it that way. Pulled out too quick in a service station. Anyway.
Is everyone thinking about moon cups?
Yeah.
I've heard a lot of people being like, what is a moon cup?
Yeah.
How does everyone
know? Does everyone know what a moon cup is?
Yeah, come on.
Several new bath mats over
there. We know what a moon cup is. That's something I've been pleasantly surprised by. Well, for a while I imposed on myself I wouldn't talk about periods or anything on stage, and it took a long while to, because I wrote a joke about it, and I was like, don't be that one, because, you know, people are like, oh, talk about periods, so I was like, oh, put a ban on myself, and it was one of my male friends, I talk about this in my show, but he says to me, he's like, why don't you tell that joke, and I was like, I don't want to be the girl talking about periods, and he leaned forward and he said, if I had to bleed at the end of my dick for 5 days a month, it would be all I spoke about on or off stage. Tell the joke. Like self-imposed bans, like I don't want to, like, not that I really understand how it works, but like if it's something that people talk about a lot, like Tinder, I feel like we've said everything there is to say on that. Yeah. So like it's not, it tends not to be shut, because like more salacious topics I kind of want to talk about, and I do think you can make anything funny. I do a podcast about serial killers, so many layers, right guys? And like we're very keen to make sure that we, and it's funny, it's two comedians doing it, you always just have to make sure the victim is the right person. It's never
like
the dead
serial
girl.
Killer.
Yes, absolutely. Make sure it's the gays. No. yeah, well, that's the thing, isn't it? You just make sure it's the right. We never laugh at the victims. We laugh at the incompetent police or the crazy guy. It's nearly always a guy that's done it. So I just think it's about picking your, always making it's that punching up, not down thing, isn't it? So
yeah.
That's what I subscribe to.
Cool. I'm just going to ask you guys one more question. What is the best bit of advice that you've ever been given for your career so far? Jump in.
Never apologise, never explain. Someone said to me once, and I was in a position of leadership, and obviously it's crazy, I actually don't know who said it. I know it's a Machiavellian ideal, which is basically just never apologise and you never explain, but it's such a female thing to do, to say sorry. Especially the word sorry, you don't even really, you're not actually apologising, you're just like, maybe trying to get through a bar, you know, but just the idea that you're saying, it's a power let go, right? It's like you're deflating yourself and you say, sorry. Oh my God, sorry guys. But I think it was good for me because it makes you think about what you're saying and what you're apologizing for and what you just like accept and take on from other people just to get things going.
Yeah.
There's an app you can get which stops you saying you can't write the word sorry, but, and, maybe actually, but like it's just, it stops you just thinking about saying things like, sorry, I just wanted to know if you'd done that work I asked for three weeks ago. Oh,
yeah.
Sorry, I wanted to know if you wanted, you know, to kick me in the butt one more time. it's just that really interesting thing, so I think that is good.
Mine's related to a gig as well. Mine's don't worry about what you can't control, which is something my mum's always said to me, and that came to practice because I was at a gig in Edinburgh in 2005 when I got paid 20 quid to get off. Because I was dying so hard. I accepted the £20. So it was like this eternity while it wove its way down from the back row, and I had the guitar and I was just like playing A minor for ages. Until it was like a tenor and 2 5s. Which was like, worse. But when I got off, I was like, oh God. And I started to really worry about gigs because suddenly I saw the potential for any audience member to pay me 20 quid to get off. And I was like, actually, this is an awful job. Like, you know, I started to think about it so much, overanalyze it, and think about it from the audience's point of view and stuff. And then I remembered that was the first time I really put it into practice. I remember Mum always saying that, and I was like, actually, I can't control that, but I can control what room I'm in. It's similar. Like, I feel like tonight I've basically been like, Kiri just said, but it is like what you just said. I was like, I don't want to do gigs like this anymore. I don't want to do gigs where there's like me doing 20 minutes in a room in Edinburgh with like three other blokes at night in a room with loads of staggering head nights in it.
where I was especially then doing quite gentle material. It was like stories and stuff. And then so I went back the next year and did like a show on my own in an earlier slot in a different room. And that was because of that, yeah, don't worry about what you can't control, concentrate on what you can control. And then when you think about what you can control, you can sort of act creatively.
Great. That's pretty much all we've got time for. And we are Standard Issue Magazine. You can find us at www.standardissuemagazine.com. Please check us out. It's something different and we'll never make you feel inferior. We'll always make you feel great and hopefully give you a laugh or make you cry because I had to mix it up. And also we just started a membership scheme. So for as little as £10 a year, you can help keep us going and we will call you a hero, a champion or a legend. So thank you very much for coming and being such a smashing audience. Please join me in thanking Henry and everyone at Macbeth for making this a great festival. And
again for downloading and listening to this Standard Issue podcast. Just a reminder that all our podcasts are available at standardissuemagazine.com/podcasts and on iTunes. Please rate, review, and enjoy.